on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, looking back at the unbelievable life that inspired the best-selling book and soon-to-be major motion picture of the same title, just one word, Unbroken. And what an apt description that is. Louis Zamperini died July 2nd at the age of 97, 6 months before he would have served as the Grand Marshal of the 2015 Rose Parade, hoping, of course, his beloved Trojans of USC were in the game. As a tribute to Louis, there will be no Grand Marshal now. He will not be replaced. Let's get back to World War II now and pick up where we left off in our Hometown Heroes interview with a then 94-year-old Louis Zamperini.
We talked about that incredibly close call that you had in the mission over Nauru. That was Christmas Eve of 42. But by May of 43, you had a mission that you probably didn't think was going to be as eventful as it turned into. You guys were out looking for another plane that had been shot down?
Yeah, it was a weird situation. When you go on a search mission, that's an all-day flight looking for enemy ships and enemy submarines. And when you get back, you get 2 days off. And we got back, and we were heading for the main gate when the operations officer drove out in a Jeep and told us to halt it. And they said a B-25 is reported going down 200 miles north of the island of Palmyra. And we want you to go look for him. Well, we knew our plane was being serviced. And he said, well, there's the Green Hornet. Well, nobody wanted to fly the Green Hornet. It couldn't get off of the ground with a bomb load. When it did get off the ground, it was a musher. Tail was down, the nose was up. And he said, well, it passed inspection, and so that's like an order. So we decided to go down and look for the B-25. And so another plane flew ahead of us from another field in Hawaii, and we got down just where the plane reported last, and we began to circle. Now, the cloud cover was broken cloud at 1,000 feet. Now, we fly a search mission at 1,000 feet so you can see something. However, because of the broken cloud, we couldn't really see the ocean, so we flew under. That put us down to 800 feet. And we're scanning the ocean, and suddenly the number one motor goes out. Well, that plane could hardly fly on four, so we're having a struggle. And just as they were trying to keep the plane straight and level and keep the altitude, the number two motor goes out. Well, with two motors on this plane, the Green Hornet just nosed over to the left wing down and just plowed right into the ocean and blew up. Pieces all over the place, oxygen tank, gas tank, and what have you. And then, of course, the plane sank. But there were two life rafts that ejected from the plane automatically. I was trapped in the waist section. My job is to hold a deflated raft in my arms in front of me. And as soon as we crashed, I ducked down low behind the tripod of the machine gun mount, and I ended up under the mount with the raft under my belly and my back up against the tripod. So I'm in there so solid, I doubt if two men could have gotten me out. And then the tail snapped off. When the tail snapped off, all the control wires go within an inch and a half of the tripod. And those are springy wires. They just curl up. They curled up all around me to make my situation even tougher. And I knew this was it. I knew that so I started to sink. And I felt my ears pop, so I knew I was down 20 feet. And then I kept sinking down into the darkness. And then I felt a terrible pain in my forehead. And I don't know what that was. But it felt like someone hit me with a sledgehammer. And then I lost consciousness. Now, before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God, help me. And then I lost consciousness. And then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife. Because I knew there was no way I could get out. And then I realized I was still in the plane, and I was fighting for air, so I started to flail around with my arms. I'm in the waist section of the ship, pitch dark, and my USC ring on my index finger snagged onto the waist window, and that's what I was looking for. And then I realized what it was. I pulled myself out, inflated my life jacket, swallowing everything. I swallowed gas, oil, and blood all the way to the surface, threw it all up, and then I came up and looked. I heard, help, help. So the pilot and tail gunner were over hanging onto a gas tank, and they saw me. And they called, help, help. So the life raft was drifting away in the current, so I'm trying to catch the raft. But I'm fully clothed with shoes on, and I couldn't catch the raft. And I thought, this is it, we're dead. And then as I turned back to look at the pilot and the tail gunner, there's a 100-foot cord attached to the trigger on the CO2 cartridge on the raft. And it's also embedded in the fuselage of the ship. And that's what inflates that raft. As I looked over towards the other two guys, the last 3 feet of that cord was going by my face. Somewhat submerged. I couldn't really see it until it got close to me. And I grabbed that and reeled the raft back in, and that saved our lives, that raft. And then I rode to my buddies, and the pilot's head had two gashes. Blood was spurting, arterial blood. And so I had to, first of all, get a compress made out of my T-shirt. And I took another T-shirt and tied that down tight. And the funny thing is, I heard a gurgling sound. I looked around, I couldn't see anything, and I never heard another sound. So somebody had come to the surface, badly wounded, and just trying to say help, I guess. But it sounded gurgling, and then we couldn't find anything. So whoever it was, it just came to the surface momentarily and then sank. And so there's three of us now in the raft. The tail gunner, within 30 minutes, he starts screaming, we're going to die, we're all going to die. And that was pathetic. And I turned to him and said, look, nobody's going to die. We'll be rescued this afternoon or tomorrow or the next day. It settled down, Mac, and he wouldn't settle down. He kept screaming. So I tried to use psychology on him. I'd taken a course in psychology at USC, Psychology 51. It didn't work. So I threatened him. I said, when we're picked up, I'm making a report to the commander, and you'll be in real trouble. He kept on screaming. So I turned my back on him, and I came around with a backhand on my knuckles. I cracked him across the face and knocked him on his butt, and he just lay there in complete contentment. He had a half smile on his face. A week later, or 5 days later, I had to do the same thing again, and after that, no problem. In fact, he got better and better as we went along instead of worse and worse. I thought if anybody hallucinates, it'll be him, but we buried him on the 33rd day, and he was sharper than he's ever been in his life. We had a program of mental exercises every day during the whole trip of 47 days, and our minds kept improving more and more. In fact, we were sharper after 47 days than we were the day we crashed.
Well, and this is unbelievable, and I know you lived it, and you've told the story so many times, and you just described it. But I'm imagining myself as someone who doesn't know your story and hearing this, and I want to highlight here some of the things. There were 11 men on your crew. 3 of you survived initially, and you just said 47 days. You had to survive for 47 days lost at sea. How did you do that?
Well, the will to live. Now, I have a lot of young people say, well, did you ever think about dying out there? I said, not once. We never talked about dying. We only talked about living. And that fortified our constitution, you see. And then we had every day without telling them, I would come up with mental exercises like memorizing songs. Okay, I would teach them the hit top 40 songs. The pilot's dad was a minister. He'd teach us the words to the songs in the hymnal book.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we'd have some exercise, thinking back as far as you can think. And what are you going to do after the war? Every day we had something to keep our minds occupied, because my professor at SC, Dr. Webster, told us in class that the brain is like a muscle. Unless you exercise it every day, it will atrophy.
Now, so you told your crewmates the day that you crashed that, yeah, we'll be rescued tomorrow or later today. You survived 47 days hoping to be rescued by friendly forces. It's the Japanese who end up finding you. They're interrogating you. You've gone from 165 pounds to 65. Yet it seems like the way you describe it now, you woke up every day energized to make it to the next day.
Right. Well, we had a strong will to live. There was no problem out there. We never thought about death or even talked about it. On the 27th day, that was our worst day on the 27th. That's when a plane flew over. It looked like a B-25 American plane. We shot flares to what had died in the ocean. The plane came down real low. We took our shirts off. We were waving at them. And we knew we'd be rescued. And then we heard machine gun firing, and the bullets went right between our legs, and one hit the metal pump on one raft, and it tore the whole bottom of the raft out. We only had one raft, 3 of us in that raft. actually 48 holes in that little raft, and none of us are touched by a bullet. You talk about another miracle. That was it.
Amen.
That went on for 30 minutes of strafing, and then they finally opened up their bomb bay doors and dropped the depth charge. And that the depth charge missed us about 50 feet, which would have killed us, but it failed to explode. So the bombardier improperly armed the bomb, and so fortunately we lived through that. And then it was a miserable time trying to patch that raft to keep it afloat because it was wrinkled, laying flat in the water, two sharks around us. And we had to keep pumping and pumping, and bubbles kept coming out. And then we just put as many patches on the top as we could. And then we got it in pretty good shape. And then we had to patch the bottom. Now, that's a trick. The raft is in two pieces. There's two tubes. So we let the air out of one half, pulled it up, and let it dry, and tried to put a patch on it while we're sitting on the other half. In the meantime, there was always two sharks, always two of them. I don't know why they don't come in threes. And they were coming up trying to get us from the rear. So the tail gunner's job was to have an oar, and he would jab them on the nose. There's something about a shark's nose that they don't like. As a matter of fact, they found out last year a great white, when they stuck his nose out of the water, they touched it with their hands, and he became docile. The trick is to get them on the nose, and so that's what I did underwater. I straight-armed the sharks, two of them, while the strafing was going on, and when I'd hit them on the nose, they'd take off. But they come back because they're still hungry. So the raft, we got in pretty good shape. We only had to pump up once every hour. And then, of course, Mac died on the 33rd day. I was surprised he lived that long.
I know that your time's limited, Louis, and I don't want to accelerate you too far here, but you end up as a prisoner of war of the Japanese. And this is incredible to me as well. One of the gentlemen who ended up interrogating you was one of your USC classmates?
Yeah. He said, when you were entering USC in 36, I was graduating. He was on the interrogation panel. Then an officer from another division on Kwajalein, he followed American sports and USC football and the Olympics. And so he came to the panel and said, instead of executing, our day of execution was already set. And anyway, he said it would better serve Japan's purpose to send him on to Japan to make propaganda broadcasts. Well, it made sense. I said, hey, great idea. So we got to go to Japan. And then, sure enough, they asked me to make a broadcast to my parents, which I wrote. And then they said, oh, you have beautiful radio voice. We want you to make another broadcast. At this time, they wrote the script, and it was propaganda, and I refused. And I think that's what Laura meant by being unbroken, on the raft and unbroken here, because Then they had me severely punished on a daily basis because I wouldn't make the broadcast. And then they finally sent me to a slave labor camp, and I still wouldn't give in. And the war ended there at Camp 4B in Nowetsu, about 35 miles from Nagano, where the Olympics were held.
Yeah, and there's a story there, too. And now you talk about that first broadcast that you got to make for your parents' benefit. Now, at that time, they believed that you had died, right?
Yeah, but the broadcast was so scrambly, the government wouldn't accept it as me. My parents were pretty sure it was me because I mentioned a few items that only they knew, but it was so incoherent that the Army said, no, there's no proof that he's alive, and so they kept me dead.
Wow. This is Louis Zamperini. He mentioned Unbroken. That, of course, the title of the best-selling book by Laura Hillenbrand, who also wrote Seabiscuit, and another fast finisher in Louis Zamperini, her newest topic. His book is Devil at My Heels. Louis Zamperini, full of life, and obviously you had to be to survive everything you did. You're captured in July of 43. Of course, the war doesn't end till 1945. More than 2 years in captivity. What was the hardest thing to endure that the Japanese did to you? What was the toughest thing for you to overcome?
To everything. On a daily basis, I'm beaten, and so I have to keep as far away from Watanabe, the bird we called him. And so I'm in a barracks with about 70 other men. So I always stayed in the back of the barracks because they come in for inspection. Two guards come in first and holler, Chef K, and so you come to attention. And then the bird does whatever he does. So he comes in. I'm way in the back. He came in, and he looked around for about 5 or 7 seconds. He kept looking around for me, and he saw me. And he hollered, you come to attention last. Well, he looked around for a long time before he said that. And I didn't come to attention last, but he wanted to work me over. So he called me up. He had a big web belt about a 3/8 of an inch thick and 4 inches wide and a 1-pound steel buckle on there, a big, big buckle. He took his belt off and hit me across the forehead, knocked me to the ground. Now, I don't go down easily, but I'm laying there bleeding, and then he took out a piece of toilet paper, and he handed it to me, and he said, oh, like, I'm sorry. And I said, well, he can't be that bad. So I wiped the blood. I stood up. I took the tissue, and I pulled it away from my head to look to see how much blood was on it, and they hit me again in the same spot.
Oh.
This time I stayed down. But I got that, you know, that was almost on a daily basis, the beatings from him. I guess they gave word somehow that because I refused to make the broadcast on Tokyo Rose's program, that I was to be punished repeatedly. So I took a beating there, and then I thought, well, if I go to a slave labor camp, I'll get away from him. But they transferred him a week earlier. Now they have 100 camps in Tokyo proper. And they sent him to the very camp that I came to, so I had to put up with him again.
Holy moly.
And again, he threatened my life over and over again. And he said, if I draw my sword, I must use it. That's Sumerai law, you know. And then he had me take care of a sick goat. The goat was dying. He says, the goat dies, you die. Well, I knew the goat was going to die, and he did too. When the goat died, he took me outside and called everybody out, all the prisoners, hundreds. And I'm standing out there alone, and then he walks back and forth with his hand on his sword. The goat die, you die. And then finally he got two guys to bring over a big 4x6 cherry wood log, which is heavy, about 6-8 feet long. And he made me hold it over my head. Well, I held it for 10 minutes that I can remember, and then I went numb. And Henley Wade from England, he had a watch, and he timed it 37 minutes. I couldn't believe I held it that long, but I wasn't conscious of holding it after the first 10 minutes.
He said he couldn't believe it, and there are so many aspects of Louis Zamperini's story that really seem unbelievable. His spirit truly was and remains unbroken, like the book says. Can't wait to see the movie. If you've read the book, or even if you're hearing about Louis's remarkable story for the first time today, I want to know what it means to you, the impact that Louis's story has had on you. Email me at paul@hometownheroesradio.com, or just share it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you could win 4 tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood. I'm going to give you the details on that before we're done. Right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes after this.